I recently went back and read through the first book I wrote way back in 1988, Ministry to Families with Teenagers. I had written these words, "Moral and faith development are influenced first and foremost by the family. Inevitably, those clumsy 12-year-olds in the middle school youth group blossom into mature adults who are strikingly like their parents." I believed that then, and I believe it even more now. In recent years, sociologist Dr. Christian Smith has served to provide youth workers and parents with practical research-based suggestions that affirm this reality and which, when heeded, foster greater effectiveness in our parenting and youth ministries. And that's what Christian Smith will be sharing with us as we talk to him about his new book, Handing Down the Faith, on this episode of Youth Culture Matters.
From the Center for Parent-Youth Understanding, this is Youth Culture Matters. If you're a parent, youth worker, educator, counselor, grandparent, or anyone else who cares about kids, we're glad you've joined us for this practical, informative, and hope-filled podcast. This is a place where together we talk and think Christianly about the rapidly changing world of today's children, teens, and young adults.
Well, Jason, we are long overdue to have this guest on our podcast, Dr. Christian Smith, who is a professor of sociology at the University of Notre Dame. I don't know if we'll get into any football conversations today or not, but we will talk about sociology and Christian faith. And we're very excited to welcome him because he has a brand new book out. And many of you are familiar with his prior books. The books that have really resonated with us here, and he has written many books, but just to highlight a few, the first one that really was helpful for us here, and we've had students read this over the years, Soul Searching, The Religious and Spiritual Lives of American Teenagers, came out in 2005. We always recommend that. Very helpful. And then Souls in Transition, The Religious and Spiritual Lives of Emerging Adults in 2009. Another one we've used here quite a bit, Lost in Transition, The Dark Side of Emerging Adulthood. And then, more recently, Religious Parenting, which came out in 2019, subtitled Transmitting Faith and Values in Contemporary America. And the book we really want to focus on today is called Handing Down the Faith, How Parents Pass Their Religion On to the Next Generation. And that book has just debuted. So we're going to get into that and talk specifically about an article that Chris wrote for First Things Magazine in the May 2021 edition. It's excellent, called Keeping the Faith. But before we jump into that, first off, thank you for joining us today, Chris. It's wonderful to have you here.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Before we get into the book, the newest book, I want to jump backwards. I want to rewind a little bit because I know some of our listeners are familiar with the National Study of Youth and Religion, which I believe you led, and some are not. So could you tell us a little bit about that and then the book that actually came out of that back in, I think, 2005 was when that debuted?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So the National Study of Youth and Religion was a big project funded by Lilly Endowment that I ran on the religious and spiritual lives of teenagers. And it was a longitudinal project, meaning it followed a sample of young people over time as they grew up for 10 years. I started thinking about this in 1999, and we fielded the first survey around 2002. So we did a survey of a nationally representative survey of 13 to 17-year-olds and also one of their parents. We followed that up with 250-ish interviews all around the country in 45 states. And really, it was just trying to get a descriptive picture and begin to analyze what's going on in the religious and spiritual lives of American teenagers. There have been some good studies before, but either they were not nationally representative or they were getting a little bit dated. So, yeah, we had a really good time. It was a huge project, and the first book out of that was Soul Searching, as you mentioned. And then we followed up. We followed these this sample of young people, interviewed them again, surveyed and interviewed them again after 2 years or 3 years, then another 5 years, and then at the end, 10 years later. So they were, you know, in college age or in their 20s and beyond. So it was a good way to see how people develop over time.
I want to ask you about one thing that came out of that, and I remember when I read the book, this jumped off the page to me because we had been you know, tracking just anecdotally with what we were seeing with youth workers and our time in youth ministry in terms of the shape of faith among young people. But when I read the term moralistic therapeutic deism, it was like an aha moment. It was great because it was disappointing because that's what the shape of faith has become, obviously. But it was great because it captured very succinctly the reality of what faith had become, and specifically for those of us in Christian churches, you know, Protestant churches, what we were seeing. Can you talk a little bit about that and unpack that for those who might not be familiar with MTD?
Yeah, so after doing a long interview in 2003, a long summer of interviews in 2003 with a lot of teenagers, I was, and the other interviewers in this project, were pretty surprised at how inarticulate and how sort of far off from the doctrinal beliefs of their various traditions these young people talked. And it was really pretty surprising. I kind of didn't expect that. And so I spent the summer kind of working through what in the world is going on here. And I gradually put together this idea, well, it's a religion. And this, my claim is that this is the de facto tacit religion of American youth. Later we would say, you know, a lot of Americans, but we focused on teenagers. At first I realized, you know, this religion is not, it's not all that theological. It's essentially therapeutic. It's fundamentally oriented about making people feel good, helping people get through life. And it's very moralistic. It doesn't have to do with salvation or grace or discipleship. It has to do with be nice, be good, don't judge people, except for those that I think should be judged, you know. Religion is essentially, everyone should be nice and moral. That's what it specializes in. Jesus, sometimes not even God, but Jesus especially was hardly ever mentioned involved in this. And then the more teenagers talked, the more it had this sense of deism. It's not like this personal, close relationship with God, as evangelicals might put it, or different traditions might put it differently. But basically, yeah, there was definitely a God, and he was out there, and he created the world, and he wanted people to be nice and all. But God wasn't really involved in life or history, except when we prayed to God and needed him to help us to get through something difficult or make us feel better. So I really wrestled with this over time, and gradually this idea of it's moralistic, it's therapeutic, meaning it's not therapy, but it's oriented toward helping us feel better. And it's a kind of deism. It's not Trinitarian, say. So I just say, well, I guess this is moralistic therapeutic deism. That's the real religion of these teenagers. And I was very happy that it resonated, because I wasn't making up something crazy. It's that everyone already knew this. I just kind of gave it a term for people to name.
I'm curious, over those 10 years with the study that you did and the number of individuals that you got to study over such long period of time, was this finding, moralistic therapeutic deism, the most important find? Or what were some other things that stood out over those 10 years that you were really surprised by or even hypothesized and then had to change over those 10 years? Because I know that was an incredible realization that we as youth workers and those that are working with youth workers were able to grasp onto. But I'm curious if that was the most important find, or if there was something else that came out of those 10 years that you just said, wow.
Yeah, good question.
Kind of blew me away.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on what you mean by most important. You know, different things are important in different ways to different people. I would say that's the one that caught on the biggest, that people really sort of remembered. It was the biggest hook that sort of the project gave people to hang on to. I think another big realization for me, it shouldn't have been, it was pretty obvious, but a big realization for me in this project was how important parents are in forming their children, because we have these narratives in our culture that, you know, teenagers don't listen to their parents or respect their parents. A lot of this is sort of leftover stuff from the 60s and 70s that baby boomers thought they were experiencing. But it turns out, both in what teenagers told us straightforwardly and what the statistics told us, that parents are just the most important, for better or worse, and not always for good, influence in forming their children's lives, and more generally, adults in the culture. So, I think a lot of parents it's raising their teenagers is so immediately in their face, and they're such sometimes intense struggles over things that they can lose sight of the big picture. And the big picture is that they're still really important. And even if their kids kind of diss them or pretend they're ignoring them, they're not. They actually pay attention to what's going on and have been formed by them for a long time. So I think one of the upshots of that is, you know, parents should feel more authorized or not feel so irrelevant to what's going on in their kids' lives, even into their 20s. So that was another one.
Mm.
Wow.
Hey, go ahead, Jason.
Well, I'm just even curious, even over those 10 years, one of the things that I've talked to Walt and others that study youth culture is how quickly things are changing within youth culture. And I'm just curious, over those 10 years, which even when you say 10 years and I say 10 years ago, it seems like a whole nother age. Did you find the rate at which anything was changing fascinating? I knew you had a group that you were sticking with, but was there anything that you saw within that changed over that time that was rapid or could give some details for the next wave of youth that we're now talking about?
Yeah, so I mean, that's a good point. The change has been incredible. A lot has happened, and the NSYR feels like ancient history in a way. But to answer your question, I would say, this was not the focus of our study, but it was clear this was happening as we were doing it, and that is the explosive development of social media, of iPhones, of different things going on in the internet. I remember hearing for the first time, like, oh, there's this new thing called Twitter, and you know, all these new apps, and Tinder is passé now, and there's so many. So it's just, again, we weren't out to study social media, but it was clear that this was running in the background, and it had and would have huge consequences. I have some sense of that, but I think we're still in the midst of figuring out. I mean, it's still exploding, and we're still in the midst of figuring out what is this doing to our culture, to our relationships, to our politics, and so on. Yeah, so I would say the biggest thing would be the transformations in technology and especially social media. Of course, the 2008 real estate meltdown and financial institution meltdown also happened, and Great Recession. So that was something of a bombshell in the lives of these young people who were just shifting into trying to grow, get independent, and that had consequences too for their schooling, their ability to get jobs, maybe having to live at home longer, and so on. Yeah, I would say the digital technology is the biggest.
With all of those changes, as you think back to what you first described as moralistic therapeutic deism, how has that morphed and changed over, let's say, the last 15 to 18 years since you identified it as such with that label?
Yeah, I'm not sure that moralistic therapeutic deism has changed at all in American culture. I think it's still out there. What changes is when people grow up. As teenagers, it's pretty easy to believe in moralistic therapeutic deism because the world is relatively simple. Most teenagers have not lived life long enough to have really worked through some super hard stuff. So what we found was, you know, a 13, 14-year-old could say that doctrine of MTD pretty straightforwardly and really believe it. And it probably did help them, you know, get through their tests and their breakup with their girlfriends or whatever. But as these same people got older and sort of had more challenges in life and realized, well, life is messy and things can be difficult, what we found is they still believed in MTD generally, but it became a little more tentative, the edges of it a little bit less confident, the edges of it became a little more uncertain. And part of that, I think, is actually moving from teenage years into the 20s, a good chunk of young people are sort of distancing themselves from the religion they were raised in anyway. So there wasn't a sort of confident commitment that MTD was the truth. But you know, as we study adults, parents too, a lot, you know, it's clear the sources of MTD are not just teenagers making it up. It comes to them from the larger adult world, unintended and intended. So I would say MTD is there, it's deeply rooted out there. But the way individuals think about it sort of morphs around as they get older and experience life and see when it does and doesn't, quote unquote, work.
And at that point, are you seeing, or do you have any sense of, you know, is the movement largely away from that and into, you know, more biblically based Christianity, or is it more a move to deconstruction and just saying, that's it, you know, I'm done?
I mean, I think there are attempts to have movement in local settings into more biblically based Christianity. I mean, clearly, people in their individual lives are going in all different directions, and so are congregations, and so are denominations. So that it's a lot of complexity. But I'll tell you a story that's interesting. In the middle of NSYR, we studied some local congregations near my university. And one of them was an evangelical church. The pastor was all over our research. He had his entire board of elders read soul searching. They were committed, absolutely committed, intentional not to do MTD at their church. Well, we did some ethnographies of their youth group. And despite their, like, all of that awareness and intentionality, it turns out that their youth group was sort of unintentionally, for reasons that are understandable, sort of reproducing MTD, like what the main message of the youth group was: moralistic therapeutic deism. I'm not saying they were dumb or malicious or anything. It's very hard to get away from that in the larger culture and the way some traditions talk about the faith, especially when you're trying to, you know, encourage kids to see, you know, there are benefits to this. There's good reasons why you might want to stay in church and be a Christian. And so it just was super ironic that in a church that was bending over backwards to get away from MTD, inadvertently in their youth group, that was the primary message.
This is so good. We're going to come back. We're talking with Dr. Christian Smith, a sociologist who's written extensively on parents, on adolescence, on the shape of faith. And we're going to jump into a discussion about his new book, Handing Down the Faith: How Parents Pass Their Religion On to the Next Generation. Stick with us.
If you enjoy listening to Youth Culture Matters and would like to support the ongoing efforts of this ministry, you can do so by visiting cpyu.org/giving to make a donation. Your prayers and financial support make this podcast possible.
Thanks for listening to Youth Culture Matters. We are privileged to have Dr. Christian Smith with us, and we have been talking about MTD, moralistic therapeutic deism, but we're going to do a quick turn here and start talking a little bit about the influence of parents on religion. And specifically, I would love, Chris, for you to talk a little bit about a recent article that you had, which was based upon a book that you have called Handing Down the Faith: How Parents Pass Their Religion On to the Next Generation. So talk a little bit about parents and even what we notice of an influence, because I think that parents so often think they don't have an influence on their teens' lives. So could you just for a brief moment speak into that and speak into some of the research that you've been finding?
Sure. So, I mean, I've had parents tell me, like, well, my kids stopped listening to me at age 13. And I'm sure it seems like that, but you know, what we have figured out as sociologists is just not true. They listen in a different way. They may pretend they're not listening, but they still listen in almost every case. So I think parents really feel kind of disempowered and irrelevantized, and of course, everything going on in the media and in school and the social media and cell phones and Netflix and all can really give the impression that parents just get shoved to the side. But it turns out parents still remain really important, as I said earlier. So we told this to Lilly Endowment, and they were like, "Hey, well, let's do a study of parents." And out of that came some more insight into what really seems to work in terms of parents who are intentional in passing on faith to their children, and what doesn't. And a lot of it is common sense and pretty basic. But again, if parents aren't intentional, intentionality is the crucial thing, and reflective about their own lives, what they're trying to accomplish, what they really value in life, what they want for their children, it's easy for those years to slip by, and then it's sort of life goes on and their children are off on their own. So the first thing is just parents thinking to themselves, like, what do I want to be? What do I really believe? What is this all about? What are my priorities? What do I most want out of my child? And again, being intentional about trying to pass that on. And the first thing is the old, you know, walk the talk thing, which is living it yourself. Like, kids are not going to do something that parents say that they're not living. Like, kids are smart. Teenagers are smart. They can see what really matters to parents and in a family. So the first thing is just being intentional about living the way, you know, you really believe in, really want to live. In general, we adults are going to get out of our kids what we are, not what we would like to be, not our ideal sense of self. So that's the first point.
I want to follow up on that and just ask you two questions. The first would be this. You know, you talk about the biggest roadblock, intentionality, just being intentional. My question is, what is the biggest roadblock? Did you get any sense of that? To parental intentionality. You say intentionality is important. I'm thinking, okay, what would keep parents from being intentional? Did you find anything?
Well, you know, a lot of parents are really busy. I mean, like, life happens, and before you know it, the week's over, and then the next week's over, and the next year's over. So busyness, distraction, competing values, not being clear on, like, how relatively important in my life is church, is Christian faith, compared to, you know, a raise or moving on to a better job or going on a ski vacation or whatever the case may be, sort of getting priorities sorted out and sticking with them. And I think some parents have a sense, like, well, I'm not as good a Christian as I should be. Like, this sort of a self-undercutting sense of, if I'm not really the ideal model, then I shouldn't really try to talk too much about this or push it too hard. So, which of course, within a Christian framework, that's problematic, right? I mean, it's like living under the law, basically. So it can be a lot of things. It can be immediate difficulties with a child in a family where, you know, you get more focused on pushback or not cleaning up the room or whatever, rather than losing sight of the big picture.
Mm-hmm. The second thing I wanted to ask is, I love this sentence in here, children are not fooled by performances. That's in the first thing.
It also has to be authentic. It's not that the authenticity means perfection, but it means like just being who we are. Like, it has to be fundamentally, what are we as a family? What are we committed to? Who am I as a person from the parents' point of view? So, in other words, it wouldn't do to just say, oh my gosh, I have influence and I better get on the stick, and so I'm going to start talking a lot about religion, if it doesn't match up with the underlying reality of fundamental identity, fundamental commitments, fundamental ways of living. It's not going to work.
Oh, that's really good. I'm curious, in the midst of that, how important parenting styles are. So the differences in styles that parents often have. I think in the article for Keeping the Faith, you actually talk about some of the different styles, and specifically looking at authoritative, authoritarian, passive, permissive. How important of a role does that play in the influence of passing along one's faith?
Yeah, parenting style is really a fascinating thing to study. And I don't know how much your listeners know about it, but it comes out of psychology of parenting, and it's important. It matters. It's not like an overriding importance, but it's a piece of the puzzle that really matters for ways that once you understand it, it can make sense. And that is, parents, independent of, but also interacting with their own personal and family religious commitments and practices, how parents parent as a verb their children, meaning how they relate to their children, the kind of relationships they have, really interacts with their religious commitments in being able to pass on religious faith. So parents who combine the authoritative parenting, that is, parents who combine expectations, standards, rules, demands of their children. That is, their children know, I have to, my parents care about me. They expect some stuff from me. There are ground rules here. It's not just anything goes. Combining that with a kind of relational warmth, a closeness, an openness, an affective, emotional bonding with children, in general, we know already that that's the most effective kind of parenting, that that's the kind of parenting kids need. Authoritative parents who have standards and expectations, but are not cold. They combine that with a warmth and a connection. Religious parents who have that kind of parenting style are going to be more successful in passing on faith to their children than those who are authoritarian, that is, have standards and demands and rules, but are cold toward their children, essentially, don't connect effectively with them. And also, permissive parents is sort of like, oh, we're best friends, we have a great relationship, we're so close to each other, but you can do whatever you want. I don't like it's all on you. I'm not teaching you anything. Like, you've got to figure it all out. That doesn't work either. So, and the interesting thing is, this is also true of not religious parents. So if you're a very religious parent and practice authoritative parenting, your child is more likely going to turn out more highly religious. But if you're an atheist parent and you practice authoritative parenting, your child is also going to be more likely to turn out to be an atheist, because there's just something about the quality of the relationship between parent and child with that kind of parenting style that encourages the child, the teenager, to say, you know, I like my parents. I want to listen to them. I want to learn from them. I want to be like them, whichever direction that goes religiously.
This is great. These insights on parenting style are so helpful. And I'm thinking back, you may or may not be familiar with Dr. Leonard Sachs. He's written a book called The Collapse of Parenting. We've had him on the mm-hmm. podcast. Christian, mm-hmm. he's also a Philly guy like you and me. So we've had him on, and he really goes at that. And then I think about, I'm guessing you might be familiar with Haidt and Lukianoff, the coddling of the American mind, as they talk about that, because the coddling just undermines so much of what you're talking about here, which is actually so effective. So I love what you're saying here about parenting style.
Yeah, it really matters a lot. And again, not just being warm and cuddly with kids, but also letting kids know, you know, we have expectations. Like, here the way we operate, and there are consequences if you don't live up to that.
Yeah, and following through on that.
I am curious, in the research that you've done thus far, do you find a statistic with regards to, if we're looking maybe at evangelicals or, what parenting style comes out the most? And we're talking about the most effective, but I am curious if there's one that stands out the most among evangelicals, and maybe it didn't break down that way, but I am just really curious.
I hate to say this, I believe there's a table in the book that shows this, but I don't have it in front of me. I still haven't received my copy of the book, and I can't get it off the top of my brain, but I mean, evangelicals are actually pretty good on authoritative parenting in relative terms, partly because this is all relative to other traditions, not in absolute terms. But there are other studies that show evangelical fathers tend to have warmer relationships with their kids and spend more time with them. Partly the argument is because of the evangelical discourse about personal relationship with God. Sort of maps on to family relationships. So this emphasis on personal relationship, you may find some Catholics or mainliners who use this language of personal relationship with God, but it's much more prevalent in evangelicalism. And then that provides kind of a template for family relationships. That's the argument. That said, you know, there are also plenty of authoritarian parents in evangelical circles too. You know, like, this is the truth. This is what the Bible says. I'm your parent. You just do it, and don't bother, you know. So there's a lot of diversity out there, but I think in general, what we found is authoritative parenting is probably the most dominant type, but there really are parents who are just passive or totally disengaged. Like, I'm not connected to you emotionally, and I don't have any expectations of you either. Those are the kids that are the least likely to go on to become religious if their parents are.
That's a good segue to the next point you make in the article, because, you know, if we are warm and we're back and forth on things, we have a relationship. One of the variables that you mentioned that's so important is routine talking about mm-hmm. religion, routine talking about the faith. Can you unpack that?
Yeah. So when we were writing the first survey questionnaire, we just had a whole long list of all these religious practices that might happen in church or at home. One of them just happened to be talking about religion in the family on a sort of a regular basis. It turns out that variable is so strongly correlated. Like, you can't do anything to get rid of the effect of that variable statistically on kids who turn out to be more religious later on in their lives. And so if you step back and think about it, what does it mean that parents would create an environment at home where religion is talked about naturally and regularly? Well, one thing it means is religion in that family is not segregated. It's not compartmentalized to, like, well, this is something we do 2 hours and then we get back to real life. All right, if you talk about religion at home, it's sort of integrated into everything. It's not sequestered away into a little compartment. The second thing is, if parents create that kind of environment, it signals, it's not just signals, it's the reality that somehow religion does connect to the rest of life. If you're talking about ethical issues or maybe social issues or political issues or personal issues or relationship issues, that religion has something to say about that. And so that suggests this is a more holistic, integrated way of life, again, rather than just a club you belong to, you go to and then leave when you're done. I think it also suggests that parents that can do that have a certain comfort level with their own religious faith, and so therefore are able to talk about it and don't freeze up or don't feel like they're bad people when it comes to religion or failing them. So all of that just has effects in forming young people. So in soul searching, it's in one place I think I talk about religious discourse, theology and spiritual talk are not the first language of American culture. The first language is more individualism and the economy and these sort of things. So what do we know about learning a second language? You don't learn it by just sitting down a week, an hour a week, and reading a textbook. The best way to learn a second language is to be immersed in a culture, in listening to people, even if you can't speak it yet, and then practicing it yourself. Well, when families do that at home, that's exactly what it is. Children learn how to think through and talk about and work through sort of the language of faith. I had a graduate student who's Mormon, and Mormons talk about religion a lot. And the one thing he said was, not every conversation has to start off as a religious conversation, but no conversation ends without having discussed sort of what religion has to do with it. It's always connected. It's always has some linkage to it. And Mormons are pretty good at passing on faith to their children. I'm not saying they should become the template for everybody, but there's something in that you remind kids, you know, this, we're Christians, let's say we're Christians. That's relevant for whatever else we're talking about. There's some connection there.
Yeah, and I love this. And as we think about this, I'm thinking about conversations and the fact that during the teenage years, our kids go through this process, you know, developmentally of making faith their own, which may mm-hmm. mean that they start to express doubts. They start to express, you know, questioning facts about the faith or things that they've learned. How do you recommend that parents handle those kinds of things, doubts, complications, alternatives, all of that?
Yeah, well, it kind of goes back to being authentically whatever we are. So in other words, what's not going to work is just start preaching or demanding or suddenly moving into some kind of new mode of relationship that's essentially the children are going to feel like, wait a minute, what are you talking about here? So, but I would say what's best is for parents to be honest, like, not overwhelm kids with too much reality, but basically say, yeah, like, doubts are okay. Yeah, like, I've had my own doubts, or when I, at this time in my life, this was hard. And so create an on-ramp to reality without turning it into just kind of a free-for-all, oh yeah, isn't life a big mess? And who knows what so I think the best kind of way to approach it is for parents to say, look, here's what I believe, here's what we believe, here's who we are, here's why we're committed to this. Let the kids know what's running on in the background. And then to say, you're going to have to figure this out for yourself. We raised you this way. We would like you to become this. Obviously, you have to choose that for yourself. In this culture, at least, you have to impersonalize it. You have to embrace it. And we realize you may go through some difficulties with that. We can't control that. We're here to help you. But what we would like for you, because of our beliefs, is to see you become this kind of person. So that both gives them some direction, some sense of values, some sense of expectations and hope, without pressuring or, you know, forcing anything or coercing. And then it leaves open the conversation for further development, like, well, why and how did you get there and how did you work through things? And, you know, not every family is going to be able to have these conversations, but I would say that's kind of the ideal mode. It fits perfectly with authoritative parenting too, which is, here's what we hope, you know, here's why, here's really what we would like to see from you. But at the same time, it progressively giving young people the space in the context of unconditional love to work through their own issues and personalize it for themselves.
Yeah, it's a great balance between grace and truth. Well, we're talking to Dr. Christian Smith. We'll come back and continue our conversation after the break. Youth workers, are you looking for ways to continue your ministry to parents during these difficult days where parent ministry is more necessary than ever before? Would you like to bring CPYU to your church in spite of COVID-induced limitations on travel and gatherings? I would love to come to your church in a personal, live, real-time virtual format. We are now offering several different one-hour seminar options, including Q&A, that you can now book at a time that is most convenient for you and your parent group. Participants can join as they gather in one place together or from their own homes. You can learn more about these seminar options by visiting our website at cpyu.org and clicking on the link for the Virtual Parent Seminars. Remember, to learn more and to book a CPYU Virtual Parent Seminar, go to cpyu.org. Well, I want to remind everybody who's listening to this podcast that everything we mentioned today, everything that Christian Smith mentions, or everything we mentioned about books, websites, articles, and other resources, if you go to our homepage, cpyu.org, and you click on the link for the player for this particular episode of Youth Culture Matters, underneath that, Chris Wagner here at CPYU will have listed and provided you with links to everything that we've talked about today. So please, if you would, take some time to go there and avail yourself of these resources. And as always, we say, you know, like our podcast, subscribe to our podcast, leave a good review, share it with other people. That's always helpful for us. Well, Chris, this is the last recommendation you make here. I love channeling for internalization. And I had to read through down further to understand exactly what you meant there. But it's brilliant what you're saying here, because it's so necessary. And yet in so many corners of the world of Christianity, which is the world that we're operating here, our local churches make it difficult to do this. Can you explain what you mean by this and unpack it for us?
Yeah, so channeling is a term that sociologists of religion have for the way that parents can guide and nudge their children and steer their children, but in a non-coercive way, into, you know, the right kind of relationships, the right kind of exposures, the right kind of activities that help them form the right kind of friends, meet the right kind of people that will help them to develop in healthy ways, in ways that are good for their faith, in ways that parents would like to see their children develop. So, but just to be clear, this is not like channeling of another soul or a dead spirit, yeah, or something. That's another use of this.
I didn't think that. Just so you know, my head didn't go there. So
yeah, you're not channeling somebody else like speaking through you. Channeling has to do more with like digging channels where water can flow, is almost. So the idea is something. Channeling is balances not coercion on the one side, but not hands off on the other side. It's not laissez-faire. That is, parents are, again, intentionally thinking about and discerning and planning, like who would be good for my child to get to know? What would be a good activity? Now, presumably most parents do this, but channeling is a pretty active process of saying, hey, why don't we go on the retreat this weekend? And then when we get there, hey, I want to introduce you to this great person you may not have met in church, et cetera, et cetera. Or maybe you shouldn't go out, maybe you shouldn't be on this activity at school, but maybe you should do that. And so all of these are examples of channeling, but it respects the child's sort of will and interests and decision making. It's not coercive. It's not saying you will do this and you won't do that and you must do this. That doesn't work in our culture, right? It might work in another culture, but it doesn't work in our culture. So in terms of passing on the faith, channeling works by, say, building relationships with others, help encouraging or facilitating or fostering young people to build relationships with other people in church. So again, as a general rule, what matters in forming people is relationships more than programs. It's community more than sort of one-off events. And so as one example, another beyond parents, a huge influence, or not a huge, but a very significant influence on whether young people will continue in faith and church is how many adults they know in their religious congregation that are not family members. Like, this is about the third most important factor that we've pulled out statistically. So you think about it. If a young person goes to church with their family, they sit together, they do their thing. When it's over, they get up and leave. That's a totally different experience. That's not a community experience. That's like an event or a performance experience. Totally different than if people know each other and after church is over, people are talking, and not just the kids talking with kids their own age, but they're able to talk sensibly to other adults, or other adults, proactively responsible, mature adults, right, who you could trust, like get to know the kids and talk to them, or maybe even just start off knowing their name and asking how they're doing. It's amazing how many teenagers, other adults in church, don't even know their name, who they are. It depends on the size of the church. But so parents can proactively channel their kids into those kind of relationships, those kind of connections, and help build a community and a bond with the faith and the church through relationships.
Yeah, and one
without being coercive.
Yeah, and one of the things you mentioned here in the Keeping the Faith article in First Things is that adults, as they engage with young people, you know, kind of step over that line of fear and really work to get to know these kids, that we talk about serious topics beyond superficial chit-chat. And I found that, you know, not only are many adults timid about approaching a teenager, they don't realize how valuable that is and how positive that is in a young person's mind to have an older person, you know, take an interest in them and care for them, but to talk about more serious topics. I love that you say that.
Yeah, I mean, you can't just walk into a teenager's life from the outside and start talking about heavy things, right? It takes some time, it takes getting to know each other, it takes building some trust. But I have seen this happen in churches where sets of teenagers just know other adults know who they are. They care about them. They ask how they're doing. And then, you know, on any given Sunday afternoon, if they're playing pool in the basement or something together, just hanging out, real stuff can come up. And then the kid learns, you know, adults learn that teenagers are real human beings, not from other planets. And teenagers learn that adults are real human beings. You know, they have a lot they can offer. They have their own struggles. They've been through a lot in life. That sort of thing can be so important in forming young people spiritually, in terms of their identities, in terms of their commitments, in terms of where they consider their home to be.
Well, the thing that I love about what you're talking about with channeling is it similar to something that we've talked about in the past with regards to a 5-to-1 ratio with consistency and congruency, 5 adults for every 1 child who are speaking the same thing. It sounds like that's a lot of what this is, that it's a passing on of the value beyond just the parents in the home. It's other adults like the youth pastor. A couple that's a little bit older that's in the church that knows your child. So it's adding that number. So it's not just a 5-to-1, it's just increasing the ratio of those that are being consistent and congruent with what you're sharing in the home. Is that a fair way to speak that?
Yeah, that's exactly how it works. And that is, like, in emphasizing the centrality of parents, we don't mean to suggest nothing else matters. A lot else matters. Youth group matters, all kinds of things matter. What we're trying to say, though, is all of that has got to be reinforcing what parents are doing at home. It's built upon. It sort of adds a synergistic effect to it. All those other things can, very rarely can they replace the role of parents. But when parents, but they can reinforce in a very important way. So, and the idea of channeling is that the parents are intentional about that, that they're smart about that, that they try to make things happen. They try, it's kind of like orchestrating something in a careful, but not controlling way. You just try to, over time, you try to orchestrate, you pull the pieces together. And really that can just be a matter of, hey, let's spend 10 more minutes talking to people before we take off. Or, hey, let me just introduce you to somebody I know. Isn't that kind of cool? They also have an interest in computers or whatever. It doesn't have to be a huge project. Again, it's just a matter of being thoughtful and intentional about trying to connect one's kids to good things.
You know, go ahead, Jason.
Well, I love the aspect of this because it also means that it's when building community, it's not just generational, it's intergenerational. Like there is a dynamic to this that is it's older individuals. And there's something with this generation that we are seeing with regards to engagement with those that are older. And so I'm just curious with the regards to the dynamic of the intergenerational aspect, how important that is.
Yeah, I mean, it's very important. Almost every social institution in our society and in many societies stratify people rigidly by single ages. Schools do that. Almost everything is like, how old are you? Okay, we'll put you together with everyone exactly that age. The latent premise being young people should be socialized by their peers, which sociologically is insane, right? So churches, communities of faith, are one of the last institutions where there's ongoing serious intergenerational contact. Like you can have intergenerational contact at the ballpark or a concert, but those are passing, they're fleeting, everyone's a stranger. At churches, it can be a community. And so it's an opportunity for young people who otherwise are being influenced, surrounded by mostly people their own age that don't have any more maturity or insight about life or growth. Churches can actually connect people intergenerationally. And whether young people will say, oh, I'd love to get to know some grandparents, they may not say that, but after it happens, you know, it can be a wonderful thing for young people. And actually, I think there's a lot more openness to getting to know adults among teenagers than I ever suspected before I spent the summer, multiple summers, talking to them. I think there's much more interest, but they're not going to take the initiative to say, hey, why don't we start a way to get intergenerational connection going here? They're not going to say that. It's up to the adults to make that happen without it becoming a formal, overbearing, like sort of uncomfortable mentoring program or something, right? It's, again, it's relationships more than programs.
Yeah. You know, as you're talking about this, one of the things that came to mind is we did a podcast a while ago with our friend Tony Souter, who started what's called the Pray For Me campaign, where he gets older members of the congregation praying for young people. And that really has served as a catalyst to get to know these kids and for kids to get to know the older folks as well. He just came out, I saw over the weekend, with a Pray For Me guide for grandparents. And you just mentioned grandparents as well, somewhat of a generic way, but specifically, you know, my own grandparents, you know, or a grandparent with their own granddaughter and grandson. Can you talk about the importance of that in this whole scheme?
Yeah, so of course there's a lot of diversity in family types and family relationships, so it really will depend on the specific situation. But grandparents and also aunts and uncles, it doesn't have to just be grandparents. It can be an uncle or an aunt or that kind of figure. They can also play an important, significant, formative role in young people's lives. It's the fact that so much responsibility falls on the shoulder of parents is in some ways unfortunate. Like I don't think that's the ideal way things should be, but that's how things have developed in our culture and society. But beyond that, grandparents, again, can either reinforce what the parents say, and so the children know, wow, there's a real network of my larger extended family that believes this, and they're invested in this. And that speaks something to young people. Or if there are parents, in some cases, there are parents who are not playing that role, grandparents or aunts and uncles can step in. You know, some parents have been just recently wiped out by divorce, or they have mental illness, or they're so far in debt that they're having to work two jobs for a while to get out of it, or they're in jail. Like, we shouldn't assume everybody's a nice middle-class college educated. So there are a lot of situations where parents either aren't or can't play a kind of a faith-forming role that ideally they should. Well, aunts and uncles and grandparents and maybe eight different ages of cousins can sort of step in and play a, not exactly the same, but a similar, a parallel kind of role. So there are kids we talk to, they say, oh, my parents don't really care about this, but my grandparents come and pick me up every week and we go to church and then I go to have lunch at their house afterwards. And I know, or they might say, I know grandma would say this about, you know, this issue. It's in their head. Again, they may not let the world know that they're worrying about, you know, they're thinking about their grandparents, but it's definitely there for them. So the grandparents and other family members too should feel empowered. It's tricky, you know, you have to navigate with the parents, not, you know, they don't feel like you're moving in on their turf or whatever, but that is also another important aspect of all this.
Yeah, boy, this is so good. You know, there's a question we like to throw out at the end because we have both parents and youth workers listening, and you've given such good guidance and direction that's come out of your research to each of those groups. But I'm wondering if, you know, final word, sentence or two to parents, a sentence or two to youth workers, you know, just of directive, because that's so helpful. You know, I read your things and I'm going, oh, I have to do this, or I have to think more about this, or, you know, in our church, we need to be more intentional about this. So is there any final word you could throw to both of those groups separately, maybe first parents, then youth workers?
Yeah, no, actually, I'll start with the youth worker.
Okay.
Because that's the first thought I have here, and that is, I think way too often it happens that a triad, an unhealthy and unhelpful triad develops between youth workers, and parents, where the youth workers hear from the youth all these bad things about parents, and then they sort of an immature youth worker will actually try to have a stronger relationship with a more understanding and more confidential and more sympathetic relationship with the youth than their parents have. Like, they become a substitute parent figure, or else they just get grumpy about the parent. Like, the youth worker is like, why don't these parents do what they're supposed to? Why are, you know, they just get a bad attitude toward parents. The underlying reality is, one way or another, youth workers should be making parents their allies. They should be connecting with parents. They should be ministering to parents, you might say. In other words, the youth workers are not going to be very effective working with teenagers if parents aren't on board and parents aren't sort of cooperating with the larger program, the larger picture. So rather than an antagonistic relationship in that triad, there needs to be a synergistic, like the adults working together in the same direction with the youth and not sort of dividing and conquering, so to speak. So I realize that can be hard. Parenting is not easy. And youth ministers need to realize this. Not all youth ministers have been through it enough to realize this is like one of the hardest things you can do in life. And life is really hard, you know, it's really hard. And so in some ways to not just be so judgmental about parents, why don't they do this? And there are some parents who deserve some judgment, clearly, but to do whatever they can to work with parents and to support parents and to bring parents in on the process, rather than segregating the kids away from parents and saying, okay, now's my time to have my influence on you. I'm not saying all youth ministers do that. I just think that that's a temptation in the dynamics of the way this stuff works for youth ministers to move in that direction. As far as parents, I mean, you know, there's a lot that could be said, and it really varies according to the parental type. But I think maybe two points. The first point goes back to the very beginning, which is just figure out who you are, what you believe in, what you're going to do in life, what really matters to you, and do it. Don't get distracted by less important things. And when it comes to Christian faith, you know, really sort out what role that's going to play in life, and then really be clear about that with your children. Say, this is the priority. Here's where this fits, et cetera. That whole spiel that we talked about before. But the second thing is not to take on too much responsibility, like not to take on responsibility that is not yours to have. So it's nobody's responsibility to make certain, it's God's responsibility, we would say, right? It's not the parent. The parents can only do so much. So parents should parent, but not become God. You know, parents, and that can mean specific things like, well, okay, if your child's having a rough time, if your child's heading off into left field, like you do what you can as a parent, but you can't control that. Like, and there's no use feeling guilty or terrible. Most families have kids that, you know, don't turn out really the way parents would like it. Parents need to do their best and let it go. Like, let God be God, let children be children. Not to think, oh, it's all on my shoulders, I need to make this that's not going to work either, right? So on the one hand, take responsibility for parenting, invest in that and do a good job. On the other hand, realize I have limits to what I can do, not as an excuse to let themselves off the hook, but to realistically recognize, here's what I can do, here's what I can't do. Here's what I'm responsible for, here's what I'm not responsible for. Here's what I might have regrets about from the past, but I'm not going forward feeling guilty and all bad and worrying my head off that, you know, things aren't turning out exactly the way I would like it to be. Mm-hmm.
You said at the top of the podcast, basically that, you know, everything you learned, you sort of alluded to this, was just sort of, you know, common sense. And I'm thinking to myself, common sense is what we need to hear. And that's really what you've communicated here. And it's so easy. I'll say this, you know, first and foremost, as a dad, and even as a grandparent, as a husband, as, you know, Chris will tell you, as a coworker, you know, common sense just goes out the window sometimes, and we need to be reminded of this. And I really wish during this podcast I had brought my little buzzer, my ringer in here to just hit the bell on everything you're saying, because it's it's just so true. Maybe Chris can work that in afterwards if he edits, but I really appreciate what you've done. Anything on the horizon we can ask you about? Or sometimes people don't like to tip their hand of what's coming up next, but you've been so prolific. I can't imagine this is not the end for you.
Well, I'm talking with a funder about the possibility of another study focusing on not churches or people of faith per se, but the sort of the culture going on around that and transformations that have happened in the macro scale over the last decades that would help understand why younger people, especially focusing on age 20 to 40, would view religion perhaps skeptically, or why Christian faith would have, the Christian narrative would have less traction now than it has had in the past. So the premise of that is that in order to understand what's going on in American religion and Christianity especially, we need to understand better. We have some sense, but we need to understand better what's been going on outside of it and around it. So again, this would be very sociological. How does the world around us shape us? So, but that's, I haven't gotten funding approval for that, and I don't know if it'll happen, so I can't really say anything about it. But
yeah, well,
I would love to be writing a cool book on that in the coming years.
Yeah, and I want to say this, and we'll let Jason close it out then, but I want to comment to those who have not read any of Christian Smith's books yet. You know, he just said they're very sociological, and that is true. I mean, it's good research, it's data-driven, but it is all incredibly practical, and that's what I love about it. It's just not research for research's sake. It is research that really we can use and spark us on in our efforts, both as parents and youth workers and pastors and anybody else who is working to have a positive influence on the life of a young person for the faith.
Excellent. Well, Dr. Christian Smith, thank you so much for joining us, for engaging. And again, if you are listening to this podcast, have not engaged in any of his research material books, please make sure you do so. We will have links to each of them in our episode notes. We want to make sure that we draw you to each of the resources we've discussed here on this episode. And we're so grateful for you, Chris, joining us. Thank you. And for all of our listeners, thank you for being a part of Youth Culture Matters. And make sure you check us out, give us a ranking. It always helps. And we're so grateful for this time. Until next time, take care.
Thanks for joining us for Youth Culture Matters, a podcast from the Center for Parent-Youth Understanding. If you'd like to learn more about today's youth culture, visit our website at cpyu.org. And if you have any questions, comments, or feedback, email us at podcast@cpyu.org.